Welcome to this bonus episode of Future Makers, where today I'm joined by Lisa Thalheimer from Oxford's Environmental Change Institute to discuss climate change, migration, and conflict. Climate migration hit the headlines in January, with the United Nations making a landmark ruling about the legal rights of those displaced by the climate crisis. The UN High Commission for Refugees has warned that we can expect millions of climate refugees in the coming years. Meanwhile, tensions over scarcity are stoking fears of conflict. Indeed, a new early warning tool, which uses climate data to predict potential conflict over water, was presented to the UN Security Council just last month. With temperatures and anxieties rising, how do we understand and prepare for changing human mobility and new kinds of conflict? Lisa, you specialise in measuring human mobility in response to climate change and conflict. So can we start with getting an idea of what's meant by human mobility here and how it relates to climate change?
Human mobility, as you mentioned, is a very broad term and it needs explanation itself. Voluntary migration and involuntary forced migration flows fall, for instance, under the types of human mobility. When we talk about climate change, a subcategory of climate mobility emerges. So in response to extreme weather events, people can voluntarily move, but we see much more of involuntary movements or displacement. Today, human mobility is very much influenced by changes in climate, but it's also influenced by various different other non-climatic factors, such as the economy, such as, for instance, political change, conflict, demography, you name it, essentially.
Can I just push you a little bit? You talked about voluntary and involuntary.
Correct.
And various factors that might influence that. But is there a clear, hard division there? Because one can imagine somebody voluntarily decides to migrate, say, because economic conditions are better somewhere else, and that might be to do with changes in the climate. At some point, that changes to involuntary moving because they feel they've got no alternative but to do that. Would you treat those as quite different categories?
Yes. So I think it's important to mention that migration itself is very dynamic. So things change over time, as you alluded to. So voluntary migration could, for some reason other than climate change, other than extreme weather events, for instance, due to political instability, become involuntary. So people are forced to move elsewhere. I personally would treat it as a very different category because extreme weather events come into play very differently when it comes to certain types of human mobility.
Because they mean effectively you've got no choice. You're going to die or you're going to lose your means of livelihood entirely. Is that the point here?
It affects spatial ability and the time ability for people to move or not move. So let's give the example of you have people who'd happily want to move because they got a new job offered. But because of an extreme weather event, such as a flood, they're not able to get to their destination. So what should they do? They probably lose the ability to pursue that job elsewhere in the country. And with climate change, these extreme weather events become essentially more often and more frequent, while at the same time, we need to have predictions and forecasts when, in which places, certain things will happen.
Right. Now, one thing that you've alluded to there is that climate change, as well as forcing people to migrate, can actually stop people from moving.
People find themselves often in a place where they cannot move but would like to voluntarily move. Let's take a look at pastoralists in dryland areas. So dryland areas make up for about 40% of the globe and include countries like the Czech Republic even, Mongolia, or various countries within Africa, especially sub-Saharan Africa. People would like to move with their livestock from A to B, but because of an extreme weather event, let's say you have a drought, they're not able to move and able to access water resources they're usually used to access. It might be that a renewable resource such as water is has not recharged at the rate it should have been, so there is essentially no water left. And that is very problematic because people are very used to traditional historic patterns of migration. They do that voluntarily. It's part of their tradition. It's part of their livelihood.
So would this typically be migration with the seasons, moving one place in the summer and then a different place in the winter?
Yes.
And that just becomes impossible because at one end or the other, you can no longer live as you used to.
Impossible in the sense that the typical migration path, the seasonal migration path, cannot be pursued. What would you do personally? You would probably try to find a solution. You would probably try to go a different route. You would try to, you know, still try to move and do whatever you're used to doing. However, when it comes to land rights, for instance, you tap into land which is not yours. You use resources which are not yours, and you take away resources which are from someone else. It gets very problematic, and conflicts could essentially develop over these natural resources. And it becomes especially prevalent where you have so-called climate change hotspots, so already parts of the world which are already very vulnerable to the effects of extreme weather events, which then get more frequent and intense due to anthropogenic climate change.
Right. So in some of these cases, presumably, there could have been conflicts before climate change came along. For example, somebody puts a political boundary between two countries right in the path of some pastoralist's migration route, and they can no longer cross frontiers. Is that right? But what you're saying is that climate change adds an extra dimension to that and perhaps brings much more conflict where previously there hadn't been.
So I focus very much on East Africa, where you have migration and human mobility of all sorts and types as something embedded in the country due to culture, due to tradition, but also affected by extreme weather events.
Which countries are we talking about here?
Yes, that's also a very good question. Thank you, Peter. So we're talking essentially about the countries at the Horn of Africa, Somalia, Djibouti, Eritrea, but also Kenya and Ethiopia. And all these countries have one thing in common. Migration is something completely normal. And they also have another thing in common, extreme weather events. And people over time have learned to cope and adapt with migration to these extreme weather events. It might be a flood, it might be a drought, which has been, you know, going on for the past 2-3 years. We see in Somalia and Kenya and Ethiopia that the East African drought is still ongoing. It's been starting, there's also debate about that, but roughly around 2015, and there's still drought conditions. It's coming and going, but essentially you have a lot of drought conditions and people are not able to use migration as an adaptation because conditions have been so exacerbated.
Right. So in the past, they would have migrated. Would that have been in response to extreme weather at one end or the other, or would it have been simply to find new pastures or because of changes in seasons or what?
So usually in response, despite the fact that they use normal migration patterns, which are actually not defined by our political borders, which we see on a global map. So they're quite used to moving, for instance, from Somalia over the Kenyan border or from Somalia to the Ethiopian border, vice versa. But because of the more frequent extreme weather events, it becomes increasingly difficult for people to move and to pursue their migration patterns and not become trapped, essentially. And then it gets really difficult. What do you do when your livestock dies? How can you secure income for your family? And one option is obviously to just change jobs. But we say this easily. It's not the same everywhere in the world where you can, you know, you have a normal, you have basic levels of education, but need far advanced levels of education to pursue a job, let's say in urban areas.
Yes.
We see a lot that there is rural to urban area migration, so again, voluntary, and also seasonal or temporal. So let's take an example of a farmer in Mexico, for instance. That farmer might move to the United States and is also very much involved in farming, in harvesting tomatoes in California. But the US obviously has an agreement of how long seasonal migrant workers can stay. becomes very problematic when you, due to extreme weather events, cannot go back. You cannot move. Let's say you have the drought conditions or wildfires in California and you miss your plane. As soon as you're one day over your visa, you are considered an illegal immigrant or illegal migrant. So, and that also touches a bit on the data which is collected. There are different reasons. I don't think people necessarily do that on purpose and overstay their visas on purpose. But again, this is listed as an illegal immigrant, and that is what's seen in the data.
So analyses of what's going on in contexts like that can be muddied a great deal by the fact that what turns up as an illegal immigrant may actually be somebody who, as you say, has just missed their flight because of freak weather or fires or whatever. Okay, going back to Africa, is it that typically people would have moved from one area to another in response to extreme weather at one of those places? Say they have a drought in the place where they are, so they move somewhere else. So the problem with climate change, the distinctive problem, is that you're getting drought everywhere, so they've got nowhere to move to. Is that really the nub of the problem?
I think the nub of the problem is that people need to be prepared for extreme weather events, and they are not prepared for that. And existing measures of adaptation and coping with extreme weather events are not feasible in the context of the impact of climate change, and especially in the future impact of climate change.
Right, so, and the particular method of coping is to move to somewhere else.
Yeah, just right. Essentially move somewhere else, especially with your livestock,
yeah.
And try to find a water source there, try to find pasture there, which is usually what's been done. And yeah, there are also debates on, if you have obviously crop failure and whatnot, what else can you do? In East Africa, it's also interesting because external factors such as, external in the sense other than climate, come into play when we look at state actors and non-state actors. When we look at disruptors such as Al-Shabaab, a terrorist organization. And how they come into play and how they essentially skew the picture of that normal migration we see and when we see conflict versus no conflict. Somalia is a fairly conflict-affected country over the past 30, 40 years, and that has not been only because of disruptors such as Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab formed between 2010, 11, and 12, with its peak in 2012. But we also see that state failure, the Bar government has been overthrown. That led to much more of a sustained conflict than anything else, than like short-term disruptances. And we also see, when we just look at a historical figure of crop prices and political influence and political conflict, that it's much more politics and the political economy which plays a role than extreme weather events affecting crop prices.
The thing that really gets in the news is the worry that because of these internal difficulties in countries in Africa and elsewhere, we'll end up with lots of people migrating overseas because they can't make a living in Africa. They'll come to Europe and hope they can do better here. Do you think those sorts of fears are overblown? And what do you think in general about the concept of a climate refugee?
So climate refugees is a term which has been highly debated in the broader field of climate policy, but also in the migration policy realm. The field of climate mobility research itself is fairly new still. It emerged in the 1980s, so I think that plays a bit into why we don't have a solution, what's often phrased as solution term, for climate refugees. The problem is really that we do not know whether and to what extent climate change plays a role in certain types of mobilities. So quantification of human mobility and extreme weather events and how far an extreme weather event then links and is attributable to climate change is really what we should focus on. I personally use attribution studies, so it's borrowed from physics, to depict certain different types of migration drivers, from demography to political drivers to economic and conflict drivers.
So can I ask you a bit more about that? So attribution studies, this is a field whose aim is to identify to what causes certain things should be attributed. Is that right?
That is right. So we essentially look into two different scenarios. We have one scenario where we say, okay, climate change is happening. That's our factual scenario. We have a lot of CO2 emissions and other emissions which affect the likelihood and frequency of extreme weather events. And then on the other side, we have a counterfactual scenario where we essentially get rid of all the emissions we have in our data, and then see, okay, how likely would an extreme weather event have been had we not had climate change? I use this type of methodology to see, okay, we have one scenario where we have climate change and we have certain types of human mobility. Let's stick with displacement because there is a lot of great data on displacement. And I look into my results in that factual scenario, and then I look into the counterfactual scenario without any emissions.
So just to be clear, the attribution studies here, we're not talking about what is it that caused that migration. It might be clear that that is to do with weather or something. The question is rather, is this extreme weather event attributable to anthropogenic climate change? Is that right?
Yes, and how far would have certain types of human mobility numbers, in that sense, have changed due to climate change? I think what's also very important to say is that this approach has not been done before, so it's quite novel and quite innovative.
And there's quite difficult, I imagine.
Probably that is a good... It's complex and difficult. It's not complicated, but I would say it's complex, definitely, because human mobility itself is a complex system. So disentangling various different drivers of human migration, human mobility itself.
And when you're doing counterfactual reasoning, you're thinking about what would have been the case had such and such been different. And given that the world is changing so fast economically in all, you know, all sorts of ways, globalization, you know, for one thing, it means that you're constantly, when you're doing your counterfactual theorizing, you're having to imagine scenarios which have never actually occurred. You can't look back in the past and say, oh, this is what happened then, because now the economic context is so different. Is that right?
Well, we can definitely use the results to see essentially who we should hold accountable for hosting or for doing something about climate adaptation in those areas which send climate migrants. So these results really help form policies, climate policies, as well as migration policies, and essentially to act before a disaster becomes a humanitarian disaster. So how we can essentially be prepared for. Another really important thing in that context is that people don't necessarily want to move. Imagine you have a beautiful home and it gets flooded. You don't really want to leave that house with a beautiful garden, but you'd rather stay where your friends are, where your family is, where you might have a dog or a cat, and going to a place where you have a different language, for instance, where you have essentially no clue what to do, what kind of job to pursue, where, how to educate yourself or where to apply for a job is really difficult.
Now, that's an important point, isn't it? I mean, those of us in Europe, for example, are used to living in Europe and like Europe. And it's all too easy to imagine that people from other continents may also want to come to Europe. But actually, what you're pointing out is they will have the same attachment to their homeland that we have to ours. And if they do migrate, that's often a last resort rather than something that they view with enthusiasm.
Yes, I mean, probably it's good to mention a personal example. So I myself moved from Germany to the United States to do my master's degree. So this was a fairly educational project in my life. But there were many, many fellow students who wanted to move back after they pursued an internship, after they had their degree, because they either missed home or they had a a job opportunity lined up. Sometimes it was actually because of, you know, governmental agreements. They got a scholarship from the government, and the government said, "Oh, right, you can stay within the host country for, let's say, 2 years, and then please come back, and you can use that the skills and knowledge you learned to apply into the local context."
I mean, this does raise big questions, though. And most people, as you say, are going to want to stay in their own country. So when they are pushed to move, it's going to be often something quite serious that's doing it, either extreme weather or, as you've said, conflict. How do you see the interplay between those two factors?
That's a really brilliant question. One thing to clarify is that it's a hot topic at the moment. A lot of studies are out there at the moment on internal displacement. So internal displacement means the forced migration within countries. So people having to move from A to B, but within their countries, so not essentially anything cross-border. I think in the 21st century, the nature of conflict has changed quite a bit. Conflict is both a process and an inherent feature of human interaction with a raft of expressions, stages and locations and effects, essentially. And developments in technology and the emergence of non-state and non-state actors and the societal implications of globalization, you mentioned that earlier, are altering the global policy regime at, I would say, a quite accelerating pace.
Right. And when you say altering it at an accelerating pace, is that in one particular direction or is it to some extent chaotic?
I feel like it is still very chaotic. Research is out there, research is increasing, but streamlining research results. What do we actually know? Where do we know what is happening, what's currently occurring? Which human mobility, which extreme weather events, what type of extreme weather events are happening where? And streamlining this research is really important to come up with sound and good and effective policies at the end.
So is it difficult to get a big picture on these things until some years after the events? Is that it, that we tend to be too much influenced by something that's happened very recently and which may be out of line with a big pattern? Is that?
I think that's a thing we often see in science, the cherry picking of certain hot topics and how you get funding for researching these hot topics. So often climate change and migration is portrayed as a doomsday scenario and a threat. The whole securitization narrative comes to my mind, where countries loop around the term of climate change, substitute it with a synonym, and basically say, okay, this is a national threat. We should definitely do something about it. Oh, right, let's go to universities and see what research actually says. So that's definitely a big debate around that.
So you think these things are somewhat overblown because of funding models and hype?
I think in the media it is very overblown, definitely to put your number one message out there. I'd rather prefer to have a more balanced view on climate mobilities. Okay, you have the voluntary side and, you know, what's happening essentially much more often than essentially this kind of overblown picture of, you know, this happened in one state of time and we should definitely make a big news story about that. I find that very problematic because at the end of the day, you're dealing with people, you're dealing with lives and livelihoods of people, and telling their stories is important, but giving a balanced overview. Right. There are also success stories. There are also coping mechanisms with migration which actually work. We see in small island states like the Marshall Islands, they will see a visible change of their islands. Yes. But we do not see that necessarily that much, that visible change in bigger countries or continents like Africa, which I was alluding to earlier.
So, in order to get a more nuanced or balanced picture, presumably we need good data rather than just relying on a small number of scare stories. Now, you recently published a paper, I believe, on using satellite data to track migration patterns. That sounds quite challenging. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Absolutely, I'd like to. In a recent study at the Oxford Monitor of Forced Migration, my co-author and I look into how we can use remote sensing and satellite imagery to overcome methodological challenges in studying in this case, environmental migration. And environmental migration deliberately, because we see a lot of land change in satellite images over time. So let's say you have a little picture book and you every day you take a satellite image over the course of 30 days and you flip through it and you see changes at the very same spot. So kind of that methodology we use in order to see where people are moving. So we're not tracking the individual person, but we're tracking what's happening on the ground.
So this is in terms of land use?
This is in terms of land use and changes in land.
Right. So, but we're not talking here about changes due to changes in the weather. We're talking about changes due to human activity.
We're talking about weather as well, because satellites are also able to pick that up. A lot of climate models rely on satellite imageries as a support as well. So we can essentially track both weather conditions and environmental conditions. Ultimately, weather conditions obviously affect the land surface area.
Yeah.
So it's really a kind of innovative approach to substitute what's already out there.
But the idea here is that you're using the satellite data to track migration, not by looking for individuals and their movements,
correct,
but by looking at moving patterns of what is being done by humans on the ground.
We can essentially look at the movement of the bulk of people.
Right. These are presumably slow movements. We're not talking about tracking people who move in a day hundreds of miles.
No, we don't see that. What's really useful is when we talk about financing options of how to help people, those displaced due to extreme weather events, to prove they have been displaced due to extreme weather events. So such methods from satellite imagery and remote sensing can really help to ground truth what's happening in areas we can't really access.
Okay, so you see a correlation between changes in the weather and movements of people, and these are sufficiently systematic that you can attribute the movement to the change in the weather or change in the climate.
Yes, but it'd be great if you could ask me in a year's time, because we're currently working on a methodology paper.
Right, okay.
So this paper is really meant as a starting point, also bringing together social science and more natural science, because when you talk about climate mobilities, it's a very interdisciplinary field.
Yes.
My supervisor is a physicist and philosopher, which I find absolutely fascinating. And I do work with a group, Climate Econometrics at Nuffield College. And this is obviously very much social science, still quantitative, yeah, but there are interesting aspects of how certain words are understood. Let's say, for instance, adaptation or climate change impacts. It's not necessarily the same definition. So
teasing out differences of view there, it can actually be very productive, can't it? Oh, okay, that's fascinating. So was your paper innovative in the sense of developing a new methodology which may, over the next few years, deliver results? And is that right? It rather than reviewing something that's already being used greatly?
Our point was really to use an existing methodology, so not reinventing the wheel, to act anticipatory, to act ex ante, before extreme weather events turn into a humanitarian disaster. And satellite imagery is freely available. At different scales, obviously.
So the idea is that you can use these novel methods to anticipate what's going to happen. Well, taking off from that, I mean, what levels of mobility should we expect in the future? What are the predictions? How well founded are they? What's your view on that?
So forecasting and predicting human mobility or voluntary migration in the context of extreme weather events or climate change is a fairly tricky one, when we can't really attribute climate change at the moment to migration itself. There is a study out which came up with a number of, I believe it's 143 million climate migrants by the year 2050. That is one model, but as we know, all models are wrong, but some of them are useful. I think it is very important to push more on research which goes more into the future area. My research very much looks into past events and how, you know, essentially the past informs the future, but you should have a good understanding of the past before you essentially do anything.
Yeah, presumably, if you want a well-founded prediction about the future, you've got to understand the past. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and the kind of research you're talking about, I can see how that can work if you find that there are consistent patterns between environmental change that you see in the satellite data and changes in movements of people. Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like something you can fairly reliably extrapolate. On the other hand, when it comes to what the climate will be like in particular places, say 5 years, 10 years, 20 years hence, that's pretty difficult.
Yeah, we have certain scenarios with which we can do forecasts with. Again, these are models, but it's very helpful to get an understanding and a sense of what might happen in the future and what we might expect. And based on these assumptions, we can obviously prepare for. And this goes very much into what I was talking about earlier of the acting before a disaster becomes a humanitarian disaster. So really the disaster preparedness, what can we do in order to protect people? What can we do in order to facilitate a dignified way to move and migrate? What can we do in those areas which are the sending areas? How can we make them more climate resilient? How can we increase climate adaptation?
And to what extent are countries preparing for these sorts of scenarios?
So there are various different types of how countries are prepared in terms of climate adaptation. Obviously, we have the Paris Agreement in 2015, which was a milestone. We have key documents which feed into the Paris Agreement. So, for instance, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, recently published three really brilliant impact reports on land use and change on oceans, as well as the 2018 1.5 report. So what is essentially happening in key sectors and how is the climate, how are sectors, not climate, affected by climate change?
But how much are countries specifically taking account of the need to prepare for mobility, for migration?
So you are alluding to probably what should be in the NDCs, the nationally determined contributions. However, that too is a bit tricky because migration is very often not in these NDCs. The NDCs are contributions of countries through which they state how they would like to help mitigate climate change, and they outline both mitigation and adaptation measures and how they would like to cap and keep the 1.5 goal, which was outlined in the Paris Agreement. And then,
but I imagine a lot of countries would rather say in respect of migration, no thank you, I'm not interested in them, we'd want to keep them out and just concentrate on sorting out our own population.
Well, that is probably the reason, or one of the reasons, we don't really see migration being picked up in the NDCs. I mean, it is ultimately about people, but people move. People move fairly often from A to B to work, where not, and the economy's very much affected by that. Mm. If a traffic jam hits you and you miss a meeting, that could potentially have impacts on your funding or whatnot when you come to.
There's been a new machine learning tool hitting the headlines recently, claiming that it can predict future clashes over water in particular. Can data like that help us to anticipate and react to conflict and potential migration caused by that?
Absolutely. I think it can very much help us. I was mentioning earlier, I think models can really give us an understanding of what's happening and what might happen in the future. So that ML model is essentially being fed in with data of observations, and then it learns and predicts. And these models are really fundamental in order to anticipate and being prepared. Having these anticipatory approaches and using data in order to forecast and act before a disaster strikes. These types of data are already out there, but putting that together, bringing the certain important stakeholders all on board. I think that is more the fundamental problem.
So it's a political problem.
I think it is a very much
more than a technological one.
Yes, I feel like at this moment it is very much a political issue.
A lot of noise is made in the press about mobility between different countries, and there certainly quite a lot of prominent countries tend to be very negative towards that. Are there examples of countries which are more accommodating, more open to what one might call climate refugees?
Yes, definitely. So I could think about an existing agreement between the Pacific Islands, Australia and New Zealand as one example. And then there's another existing agreement between Colombia and Spain, which share the same language as well, in which actually migration as adaptation is part of the climate strategy, climate agreement within these countries.
Can you say a bit more about the Australian, New Zealand and islands? Which islands are we talking about there?
So we're talking mainly about islands where you see a visible change due to sea level rise, essentially disappearing islands, it's often referred to. So people might be a bit more sympathetic in Australia or in New Zealand to those islands essentially disappearing.
Well, the Marshall Islands, for example.
The Marshall Islands are one example, which, by the way, have a really good climate adaptation strategy and are open to relocation. So that's a really important issue, that those populations which are affected are actually okay with relocating to a completely different geography.
Right. And New Zealand and Australia have offered to take them in. And you say there's also an agreement between Colombia and Spain. And as you highlighted, a sort of common cultural heritage there. Yes. It's nice to hear of those cases. What prospect do you think there is for large countries that are currently rather hostile to the idea of climate refugees? What prospect is there for those countries to be more open to people moving from elsewhere because of the climate?
I believe when countries, big economic countries such as the United States, experience extreme weather events and the effect of these on the population, on the local population, they will essentially see and hopefully come to consensus of what to do about these issues, are much more likely to be open-minded and see essentially, okay, other people are also affected and we should really be a bit more accommodating and we have enough space. There are economic opportunities. There are also areas where we really need local expertise in not so high level skilled jobs, as like for instance in the farming sector, in the agricultural sector. So filling economic gaps could be one option to persuade, but also if people are actually exposed to extreme weather events themselves, that I hope at least there's a consensus coming before people have to be exposed.
So things like fires in California and indeed in Australia and droughts, tornadoes, other extreme events, and maybe, for example, parts of the USA having to change their agriculture in response to climate. You think that might bring it home to them how this can be a factor more widely, and maybe make them more sympathetic to the needs of people in other countries who are suffering in this way?
Absolutely. I mean, I see very much the local grassroots movement affecting the political agenda. We see that with Greta, with the Fridays for Future movement, that one girl started a big revolution, but it took one person to mobilize various different people in different countries. But it had an effect, and I can see that the same ripple effect in a positive way can occur in those countries which are a bit more skeptic about the impacts of climate change.
So you think their skepticism might be undermined at the same time as their sympathies are enhanced?
Probably. I would hope so.
Well, that's a nice note on which to finish. Thank you very much, Lisa.
Thank you, Peter.
My thanks again to all of you for listening to these bonus Future Makers episodes. If you've missed any of Season 2's previous conversations, do go back and give them a listen and let us know what you thought. I'm Peter Milliken, and you've been listening to Future Makers.